ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Nightlife. News breakdown.
Well, many of you might recall the image of Australian Army Corporal Ben Robert Smith being awarded the Victoria Cross, Australia's highest military honour, by the then Governor General of Australia, Quentin Bryce, at a ceremony held at Campbell Barracks in Perth back in January 23rd, 2011. When he left the military in 2013, he was Australia's most decorated soldier, having won the Medal for Gallantry and the Commendation for Distinguished Service, as well as the VC. He went on to become General Manager of the Regional Network and of Metropolitan Station 7 in Brisbane. But then things, as we know, soured as more and more information was revealed about what he'd actually been involved in and his actions in Afghanistan. As a result of these revelations, Robert Smith sued for defamation, with the year-long defamation trial brought against three Australian newspapers ending last week, where Judge Anthony Bosanco found that he was, quote, not an honest and reliable witness, had attempted to intimidate witnesses, that three murder allegations against him had been proven on the standard available to him at the trial, that he'd broken the moral and legal rules of military engagement and was therefore a criminal. Now, the trial had demolished the VC recipient's once unimpeachable public reputation, with the judge also adding damningly, the applicant Ben Robert Smith has no reputation capable of being further harmed. He is currently the subject of an Australian Federal Police inquiry into alleged war crimes committed in Afghanistan, and while we don't know, Robert Smith may yet face further criminal charges over his actions in Afghanistan. Chris Masters and Nick McKenzie are the investigative journalists who initially reported allegations of Ben Robert Smith's war crimes, and last week they labelled the federal court judge's decision to throw out the former SAS soldier's defamation case simply as justice. This is Nick McKenzie's words after the judgment last Thursday.
I'd just like to say today is a day of justice. It's a day of justice for those brave men of the SAS who stood up and told the truth. Australia should be proud of those men in the SAS. They are the majority in the SAS, and they stood up for what was right, and they have been vindicated. Today is a day of some small justice for the Afghan victims of Ben Robert Smith. Ali Jan was the man kicked off the cliff. Ali Jan was a father. Ali Jan was a husband. He has children who no longer have a father. He has a wife who no longer has a husband. He was kicked off a cliff by Ben Robert Smith, and he was murdered with Ben Robert Smith's participation. There's some small justice for him.
Tonight, a special Nightlife News breakdown, and Chris Masters joins us. Chris won Australia's most prestigious award in journalism, the Gold Walkley, for his Four Corners report on the sinking of the Rainbow Warrior in 1985, and his reports on the Big League and the Moonlight State both led to royal commissions that helped, quite frankly, transform the nation. He's the author of bestsellers such as Jonestown, and he's written three books about the Australian military, including No Front Line, Australia's Special Forces at War in Afghanistan. Joins us this evening. Chris, good evening. Welcome to Nightlife.
Thank you very much, Philip.
Great to have you with us. And a week after the judge's decision, or nearly a week, how do you reflect on it?
Well, it's still soaking in. You know, actually, I was exhausted at the end of that process when we came out of court, Nick and I. I think we were both exhausted. We said to each other that we hadn't got much sleep. And the next day we were talking early in the morning and said we were both feeling a bit flat. I think it was probably because we'd been running on adrenaline. Mm. We were very worried. We didn't know how this was going to go. We obviously thought we ran a terrific case, but somehow journalists always think that defamation actions will go against them, and investigative journalists are inclined to think the worst case. It's sensible in many respects to do so. So it was a big relief. It was a vindication, and I certainly am feeling a lot better about it. I can tell you, I feel a lot better than I would if we'd have lost.
Yeah, I mean, what were your best thoughts about it? Did you think you would win? I know that the trouble with defamation for journalists, of course, is that judges, you know, generally don't seem to take very kind attitude towards journalism or its revelations, and they're hard to win, and the defences are hard to establish. Did you think you were likely to win?
No, I think when we came out of the court, I knew our lawyers did very well, but I remember some of the solicitors cautioning me not to get too optimistic, saying that it was extremely hard for us to win these matters. I think generally we feel that the courts are tough on us and the law is tough on us. The courts are tough on us, I think, unfairly because they have an unrealistic view of what journalism can actually do. You know, it's kind of silly in a way, isn't it, to think that, you know, we have 24 hours to do a story and then you might be in a defamation action where 5 years is applied to determining whether you acted fairly and responsibly. Beyond that, it's not just that we're fighting a well-heeled other side. We're also fighting burden of proof. We did plead truth, and that's a very high bar to get
over. Which is a very big bar to plead, isn't it? I mean, the trouble with pleading other defences is that they're often not very successful, and truth, if you can establish it, is a good one. But it's very hard to get to, isn't it? And without going into all the subtleties of defamation law, and they would drive you nuts and do your head in if we did.
Well, I mean,
truth is not always what it seems in a court, is it?
No, you have to have the evidence. One of the worries, I know that there was this criticism that essentially you're asking the judge to make a murder finding. I mean, he's really finding on whether you acted, whether your reporting was truthful, but the outcome of that was that Ben Robert Smith might have committed murder. Well, you know, you'd have to say that's going to be difficult for a judge in a civil court to find in such a way. I thought the judge did a phenomenal job, but I think you've got a background in the law, haven't you, Philip?
Yes, I have.
You know about the Brigginshaw standard. I mean, if you're going to make a serious allegation such as a murder allegation, then you have to have serious levels of proof. And I think through the five-year process early in the piece, we would have struggled. I think the COVID crisis helped us a little bit because we had a bit more time to secure our evidence base. We had a particularly valuable win in some of the early stages when we had access to what they called the potentially affected persons notices. The Inspector General's inquiry was going on at the time. They knew a lot more about war crimes than we did. Mm. Ben Robert Smith's counsel had access to these, what they call PAPs, and our lawyer at that stage, the now late Sandy Dawson, he successfully argued that we should have access to those same documents, and that helped us. You know, we got some more witnesses on that basis, but we're very, very grateful to those witnesses. They had a lot of guts. You know, they demonstrated a lot of moral courage. None of them wanted to be there.
No, this is an important point, which, you know, in this limited discussions we've had in the program so far about the case, that I think a lot of people are under some misapprehension about that. This was a case of, you know, the media pursuing Ben Robert Smith. And, this was a case launched by Ben Robert Smith against the newspapers. And what brought him undone, and what Nick McKenzie was referring to as justice, was what brought him undone was essentially, well, not essentially, was wholly the testimony against him by his fellow soldiers who were there with him when these actions occurred. And that's the justice, isn't it?
That's right. I mean, there were 20 of them. They were trying to run an argument that the witnesses who spoke against him were jealous. They were jealous of his Victoria Cross.
That's right.
There was a sort of a coven, a conspiracy amongst these Ben Robert Smith haters. And, of course, I was described as credulous, as was Nick McKenzie. You know, we'd been conned into believing them. But the reality is, I say 20. Are they going to really say that 20 witnesses have made this up? And of those 20, many of them had not met us, and many of them had nothing to do with the soldiers who Robert Smith alleged were, you know, conspiring against him.
Mm. Yeah. What do you make of Ben Robert Smith? This is an impossible question, I know, but how does a person who knows that he has committed these acts himself knows that there are people who know that too, that is his fellow soldiers, who also knows that those fellow soldiers have already given evidence about his behaviour and what happened and are prepared to do it again. What do you make of a person who then decides to launch a defamation action?
Well,
He must have known that he was going to lose.
I don't think so, no. I think he probably thought he was going to win for these reasons. One, he didn't think that we would be able to assemble 20 witnesses. Mm-hmm. He thought the code of silence would hold, and it generally does hold. I mean, two of the witnesses who did speak said that they had kept silent for something like 8 years. They didn't want to talk about this because they knew they wouldn't be respected by their brotherhood for doing so. And remember, the great majority of these witnesses were subpoenaed by us, and they didn't want to be there. They didn't want to help us, and they ultimately proved to be the perfect witnesses in a way because they weren't on our side, and clearly the facts weren't on his side. So they're there in the witness box and there's nowhere to go but simply tell the truth. And Justice Bosanco was very impressed. I was delighted to trawl through the 700-page judgment and see time and time again him saying that he thought that this witness was reliable, that witness was reliable. I was in the court so many times, and a lot of these people are pretty well known to me, and I knew up close that they were decent, honest, honourable people, and that the last thing they wanted to do was be in a courtroom. It can be punishing as well, you know.
Yeah.
And I had to say to myself, look, I know he's honest, but I'm seeing him being hammered. He's sometimes being hammered because of his contact with me. He's sometimes being hammered because they find an inconsistency in my note-taking with what he's said in the witness box. It might be the faintest inconsistency, you know. Was the man wearing a black robe or a dark robe, you know, and three or four days, 5 days, they'd be hammered. And I'd be thinking to myself, I know he's honest, but will the judge think he's honest, you know? And the courtroom really does find you out, doesn't it? I mean, it's a punishing process, but it's good at getting to the truth. And I'm glad that the truth won.
I'm talking to Chris Masters on the Ben Robert Smith defamation case decided last week against Ben Robert Smith. For yourself, Nick, when did you first begin to suspect that something was amiss with the Ben Robert Smith story?
I went to Afghanistan 3 times reporting, especially for the ABC's Four Corners program. Early in the stage, you know, I believed what I was being told about Ben Robert Smith. I wrote favourably about him in one of the books I wrote, Uncommon Soldier. That was published, I think, in about 2012, after he'd received the Victoria Cross. And I was in contact with him at the time, and, you know, he checked my copy. He even used that book, and he quoted it on occasions at Australia Day addresses, etc., you know, in a very favourable way. One person said to me after that book was published that I might have got Ben wrong. I didn't take that much notice of it because you often hear people disparaging soldiers, you know, despite the strong bonds of mateship. There's a lot of jealousy and bitterness and infighting, particularly in special forces. So for some years, you know, I did hear negative commentary about Robert Smith, but it wasn't about war crimes. It was more that they thought he was a bully, mm-hmm. and that there was some controversy about whether he really deserved the Victoria Cross and some of the other medals. It really wasn't until about 2016, 2017 that I came across some information that I had to put to him. I noticed when I was working on the book No Front Line about Special Forces that there was a massive inconsistency in the reporting of a combat situation from 2006, from which he was awarded the Medal for Gallantry. And the first medal that he received. And there was a clear inconsistency in that he said two armed men came into their lines, and I'd already heard by then that that this wasn't so, that what others said actually happened was that a single unarmed teenager had come into their lines, and they pursued him and shot him. Sounds cruel, sounds callous, but it's war. Even I knew that wasn't necessarily a war crime. You know, a spotter can have lethal intent if they'd been spotted and reported by radio the presence of the Australian soldiers up there, isolated on a mountaintop. There was a big chance that they'd be wiped out. But anyway, there was an inconsistency that needed to be reconciled. I ended up speaking to Ben, and in a way, Philip, if he'd have said to me at that time, "Yes, Chris, those guys have a different view of what happened, but guess what? That's what happens in war. You know, it's everybody sees it from a different perspective. It's not at all unusual. I've got no animosity towards them. It's just the way it is." But he didn't say that. He attacked them. He attacked me. He sent legal letters. He wanted to change the content of the interview that he did at the Australian War Memorial. And frankly, he didn't act like a man with nothing to hide, quite the opposite. So it's always been said that, don't forget, he sued and he brought this on. I wonder whether if he hadn't been so angry and so keen to lawyer up back in 2017, whether any of this would have actually happened.
Mm. I know some people listening will think, oh, well, look, you know what, Chris Masters wasn't there. Who knows what anyone would do in these circumstances. It's the fog of war, blah, 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 that sort of line, which we've heard many times before. What do you say to that, the line of thinking?
Well, one thing, I was there. You know, I reported three times from Afghanistan. I'm the only person to have ever deployed with special forces. Mm. But the more important point is that we never ever made an issue of what you might call a fog of war incident. Every one of these incidents that we reported and that the Inspector General investigated was far from that. It was in every situation, the people who were executed represented no threat, that there was a clear breach of the rules of engagement. Some of them may have been combatants, but by the time that they became persons under control, they became detainees. They were effectively prisoners. And it's simply against the laws of armed conflict to murder or mistreat a prisoner. And some of them, of course, weren't combatants at all. I mean, we're confident that Ali Jan, the man who was kicked from a cliff that Nick was talking about earlier, we're confident that he wasn't Taliban. And even if he was Taliban, it's still against the laws of engagement. But that was a horribly cruel killing. And Philip, it's not just morally wrong. It's also strategically counterproductive. You know, when I was there, the only time I ever got a sense that when I was out in the theatre, in the field, that something was horribly wrong was when I looked into the eyes of some of the Afghans and saw how much they hated us. Now, you go into a village like that and you kill an innocent farmer, you destroy his family, you remove their opportunity for a livelihood, and you create 10 Taliban. It was wrong on a lot of counts.
Mm. Yes, other soldiers have been there, have said the same to me in interviews over the years as well, that they worried a lot about what was going on and what the soldiers there were doing. What's going to happen now? There's the Office of the Special Investigators, and the outcomes and the findings from the Brereton report, which has never been released. What happens from here?
Well, the Office of the Special Investigator was established at the time that, that Brereton released his findings. So that was 2020. So they've been working for the last 3 years. I'm not really privy to the detail of what they're up to. I mean, I hear around the edges that they've been very busy and that they may have more information than Brereton uncovered. There's one charge has been brought against one of the soldiers that figured in the Four Corners reporting by Mark Willacy. You remember the notorious incident of the man being shot in the field. The soldier who pulled the trigger on that occasion is facing charges. We're pretty sure that there are a few others that that are likely to face charges, but it hasn't happened as yet. We don't really know.
What do you think should happen to the war memorial display and the medals of gallantry and the VC?
I remember having a conversation with Brendan Nelson because, you know, I was working at the war memorial back in 2017, and I was assisting the curating of some of the galleries, and I got on pretty well with Brendan then. I mean, our relationship sort of went downhill afterwards. But I remember saying to him that the Brereton report will come down. I had a good sense that there would be findings of misconduct by Australians and that war brings out the worst in us as well as the best in us. And Brendan and I had worked a little bit together on 2015 on the centenary of ANZAC, and I remember saying I thought that he was a man of that found good words to say to match the occasion, and that maybe there ought to be some consideration given to the ugly side of war. I'm sure that the founder of the War Memorial, Charles Bean, always felt that if we're going to report war, we should do, we must do so truthfully. So, I mean, I think that if they want to leave that stuff there, they should just simply tell the truth about what happened.
Yeah. As you and Nick McKenzie have so ably shown, there is a truth which we weren't told about what's happened. Chris, it's been terrific to talk, and congratulations on the work so far. It's been an extraordinary effort in bringing to Australians the reality of what happened, which we ought for all of us to know, and in particular for the valour and bravery and otherwise of the soldiers who told the truth as well.
Yes, I give them a great deal of credit. I think that in some respects they saved their regiment.
Yeah.
It has been an appalling scandal, but we'll always be able to say that it was self-reported by other SAS soldiers.
That's right.
And the Brereton inquiry was initiated by the Australian Defence Force.
That's right. Chris Masters, great to have your time.
Thank you very much, Philip. Good on you.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.